I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Teach for America is a national corps of outstanding recent college graduates who commit to teach in our nation's public schools for 2 years. Earlier this year, we talked with two Teach for America Corps members, Donate Nobles and Shelby Royer, just as they were beginning their first week in a real classroom in Memphis City Schools. Today, we'll visit them again to get a firsthand report on how tough the challenge being a first-year teacher really is. Also, we'll find out about a remarkable emergency medical transport system that is saving lives and preparing for disaster in Birmingham, Alabama. That's today on Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Shelby Royer is a Teach for America Corps member who is in her first year of teaching in Memphis City Schools. A recent graduate from the University of Minnesota, she majored in psychology with a minor in youth studies. Shelby earned the Presidential Student Leadership and Service Award her senior year. Donate Nobles is also a Teach for America Corps member, also in her first year, also at Memphis City Schools. She earned her degree from the University of Mississippi, where she majored in physics and minored in English and mathematics. Describe, Shelby, your first 3 months in the classroom.
My goodness. Well, there's been so many different stages to describe. I don't know. The beginning was very interesting, to say the least. It was extremely challenging, and there was a very, very steep learning curve. Because this was such a new experience for me, new culture, new everything, coming from the north onto the south for my first time. So there was a lot that I needed to get used to and just acclimate myself to. So that was just very overwhelming for the first couple of weeks. I'd probably say actually the first month. And then I got to know the culture down here a little better, and I got to know my kids and what made them tick, and starting now to get the hang of it, and things are really starting to roll now.
Anytime anyone answers a question, say, oh, it was interesting, that sort of begs a question. How was it interesting? What made it so challenging for you? You say the culture. Talk to me a little bit about what you found about the culture that was so challenging.
Well, the classrooms down here, or at least my classroom, was absolutely nothing like any classroom that I was in growing up. It's just the kids, everything about it is different. From the way the teachers interact with the kids, to the way the kids interact with the teachers, to the uniforms the kids wear. And I didn't know how to interact with the kids being a teacher with students. And I didn't know how to interact with the kids being from the north, because they didn't understand the words I said. They would laugh at everything I said because of my accent, all of my little sayings. They would laugh. They found them so hilarious. And honestly, to tell you the truth, I had an extremely hard time understanding them and what they said. So we had to get over that obstacle first, to get through that communication barrier that we had.
And you said your relationship between teachers and kids was difficult. You didn't know how to relate to them as a teacher to a student. How did you work through that?
A lot of trial by error, actually. I came in with this mindset, it's going to be such great, strong relationships with these kids right from the bat, because, you know, I care so much, and we're going to go along, and they're going to come, and we're going to have fun, and we're going to laugh, but it's going to be good because we're going to be learning so much. But really, that was not a possibility at this moment. I had to be the tough adult in the situation, and I'd never done that before. I'd never been, you know, the adult having to be the disciplinarian. So that was a role that I struggled at first to identify with.
And did you find yourself in trying to adapt to that role, becoming a bit callous or hard, or a person that you didn't recognize?
Yes. It was a very strong internal struggle for me to be this person that I thought the kids were going to respond to better. It was very hard for me to yell at the kids, and it was very hard for me to not crack a smile when they did something that was, silly or cute or funny to me. That was one of the hardest things, was not cracking a smile, because the kids saw when I cracked a smile and they took that as the go-ahead to have more freedom than they should have been, to start laughing, to start goofing around and things like that. So that was really hard for me to kind of suppress my personality in order to be the strong disciplinarian that the kids needed.
Donique, does any of that sound familiar to you in terms of your first 3 months in the classroom?
Yes, ma'am. Well, yes and no, because I'm from the South. And so it wasn't a big adjustment for me at all. I mean, the classrooms were a little bit different than what I'm accustomed to. But yes and no. Yes, it was very challenging. It still is a challenge every day. But as far as, like I said, adjusting to the culture, no, ma'am.
They could understand you and you could understand them.
Yes, ma'am.
In terms of the challenge, describe what it is about the situation that is so challenging to you.
For me, one key thing is organization. Being a teacher and working in Memphis City Schools, there is a ton of paperwork, whether it's Memphis City School paperwork, whether it's grading papers, whatever the case may be. And I'm not the most organized person in the world. So that was a really, really big thing that I struggled with. And I actually still am struggling with that. Also, being that I do teach special ed, having children on all different levels and having to plan for my children and pulling things for my children and being sure that I am able to meet all of their needs, that's a challenge as well.
Yeah, special ed teachers have lots of extra paperwork.
Yes, ma'am, we do.
I know. My sister is one and has been for many years. Donique, how have your students surprised you, if at all?
Let me think. They're always surprises, actually. I mean, I can't recall a day when I'm like, not like, oh my God, you know. They have surprised me in the sense that, not like, I already knew that they were able to learn and willing to learn, and they're actually very self-motivated. That wasn't surprising to me because I feel like my expectations was for them to be that way. Honestly, I don't think I've had very many surprises that I didn't already anticipate, I should say.
What about you, Shelby? Any surprises that have come to you from your students?
Every day I get to know more and more students on a more personal level, that so I can say, you know, I know some of my kids so well that when they walk in that door, I know that I need to make eye contact with this one student, this one girl, before we finish the first 5 minutes of class, otherwise she's going to be a behavior problem all period. Mm-hmm. Or I know that if another student, this particular girl, if she says something out of line, I need to address it immediately or it's going to become an even bigger problem. Mm-hmm. Or like one of my young men, I know that if he gets on my floor, don't say anything unless he stays on your floor, gets up out of his desk, unless he stays out of his desk, because otherwise he'll just turn it into a bigger problem. You learn when to pick your battles. Mm-hmm. But what surprises me is that, or what has surprised me, but in a good way, is that some of my students who at the beginning wouldn't do anything and actually were very adamant to do things, everything opposite of what I asked them, pretty much, started to really come around. And I guess it's not surprise has such a, you know, I didn't expect it type of meaning, but in a good way, they realized the reason that I'm there, and it's to help them. And so they got over the initial shock of who I am and what I look like and how I sound, and they're really starting to come around and trusting me. So every day, you know, I get a little, you see that, you just make these little breakthroughs with certain kids, and it's so exciting. And so the next day, I am so excited to get to school to see what's going to happen because of the possibility of what could happen with a student.
Do you both sense that your students are making progress where it's measured today? And that's in terms of performance on test.
I definitely feel that way. And to say the least, I have one particular student who, when I entered the classroom my second or third week of teaching, and, you know, I gave him his diagnostics, he registered reading at a second grade level, and now he's on a fifth grade level, and he's actually in the sixth grade. So for me to actually see this and see that it's not really a milestone for me, it's like a major, you know, accomplishment that we made together. Of course, I think that they are, you know, learning, and it's showing. It's showing.
In my situation, it's a little different. It's not. It's maybe not as apparent because I don't teach special ed, so I just have the regular classrooms full of 30 students. And mm-hmm. for me, what I can see is it's the little things. It's the little things that are so encouraging to me. It's when, you know, one student who normally comes in and who disengages right away when the work gets hard, he works one day, he stays on task, and he understands what we learned that day. And we always take a end-of-the-day quiz. And then for them to get, for that person to get, you know, a 90% on that end-of-the-day quiz is so exciting and so encouraging. And it's really an amazing thing to share that with a student because you know and the student knows. And to work together on that and to see a student so proud of him or herself after they work hard and then to see the success that they earn after working for it is such an amazing experience.
Yep.
As Teach for America candidates, you come in enthusiastic, feeling like you're the chosen ones, and you should, given Teach for America's very tough recruitment and hiring process. Do you both still feel that way?
Actually, I never felt that way, to be honest with you, as far as like me being the chosen one or anything. I felt like everything in life happens for a reason, and becoming a part of Teach for America has been a really great experience for me because I feel like my students learn from me just like I learn from them every day. So I don't feel like being like a chosen one. I feel like actually they were given to me as a gift. So, no, I really don't.
Shelby, tell me about your experience. Do you still have that same high that you had when you were first chosen to go into the Teach for America program?
Well, I will be completely honest with you. You're right. I went in there on this huge high thinking, mm-hmm. oh, I'm going to accomplish great things and it's going to be so wonderful. We're going to make such huge strides and my kids are going to love me and we're going to learn so much. And I'll tell you what, first 2 weeks, that was the furthest thing from my mind. And I'm just being honest with you, mm-hmm. it was the hardest thing I've ever gone through. I have never in my life felt as frustrated and infuriated as mm-hmm. I was in those first 2 weeks. And I was on a low. I went from that extreme high to a very, very extreme low. And I found myself feeling sorry for myself, which isn't in my personality at all. Mm-hmm. And so I stepped back and I looked and I reevaluated and I realized that the reason I was on such a low was because I wasn't meeting my expectations for myself. I wasn't being as successful in that classroom. And the reason I was so frustrated was because my kids weren't learning. And it dawned on me that as much as these kids were trying to get under my skin, and they did, I loved them so much already. I cared for them so much. And the thought of them not learning in the school year was absolutely devastating to me. And it realigned and changed my whole outlook on everything. And I went into school the next day with this new outlook and this new perspective. And since then, since I stepped back, you know, and stopped making excuses and started focusing on the good things, even though at the time they were very few good things and they may have been very far between, I held on to those good things, you know, and got me through the days. And to tell you the truth, we're really on the climb up right now. Things are getting a lot better, and I am back on that high. I'm so excited now because you see, like I said before, you see those days where you have a student who clicks, you know, they get it and they are so proud, and the next day they come in so ready to work hard and learn again, and it's so exciting.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Donate Nobles and Shelby Royer. They are both Teach for America core members in the Memphis City Schools. Donate is at Fraser and Shelby is at Hamilton. What have been your best moments?
I feel like my best moments have been the small things that happen in class when my child or one of my students realize, oh, that's it. Or when one of my students, like, I try everything that I can and I just could not get, you know, one of my children to understand why this is this way, and another child explains it another way, and it, like, all of a sudden the light comes on, like, oh, that's what you're talking about, Miss Nobles. I mean, it's just any moment that is a teachable moment and they learn something and they get it and they show me that they really understand it, that is like a moment that, like, takes your breath away.
Shelby, what about you?
When you asked me that question, I just started smiling because lately things have been going, I've been having so much fun in that classroom lately because I'm really starting to develop my teaching style. And so I'm getting the hang of teaching to these kids and we're learning and I'm starting to be able to let a little of my personality shine through. So we're having fun now in class and the kids are realizing that. So a few of my favorite moments are when the kids come in and they can tell I'm in a good mood. And so they come in, they sit down, they're quiet right away because they know we're going to do something fun. And then the whole class, all 30 kids in the classroom are engaged in the lesson. And we're goofing around and we're having fun, we're laughing, but we're learning at the same time. And then when the end of the day quiz rolls around, we got 100% on it the other day. And we were so excited because that was the goal we set for ourselves at the beginning. And we did it. It was just such a great classroom environment. And I was really, really excited about that and so proud of the kids for creating that environment and fostering it. It was just great.
Is adjusting your teaching style and your method just a matter of learning on the job? Is there any other way you can learn that? I mean, would it be true that what you learn in either a college classroom about education or when you go through Teach for America's training in the summer, can it only go so far in terms of preparing you for what you're going to find in a classroom?
I think so. I'll tell you what, those first couple of weeks for me were, I felt like a fish out of water. I really struggled with trying to, I still do. I mean, I'm still developing my teaching style, and that was something that was really hard for me. I went back and forth with, you know, one day I was the really mean, cold stone, don't talk, don't do this. And then the next day I was like, well, let's try it a different way. And I'd try to laugh a little more with it. And I realized that that was the worst thing I could do, this inconsistency, because the kids didn't know what to expect. And so now I'm starting to get, you know, still making sure that the environment is safe with the rules and the consistent consequences, which is in turn allowing me to have a little of more of my personality shine through, where we can laugh and we can make jokes. And it's pretty exciting, the potential that there is in this classroom for success with my students.
Mm-hmm. Donique?
I agree. I don't feel that there's any textbook, any college class, any Teach for America seminar that can prepare you for this. I feel like it's one of those things that you just have to be there. You know, you have to actually, like, go out and try to swim. Like I said, the prep work, of course, it's very important and it's needed and everything, but there's no way that anybody can tell you this is how you do it, this is how it's done, because, I mean, there are, you know, millions of great teachers and none of them have the same teaching style. So I feel like it's just about going in there and doing it. And it's really trial and error. I mean, I know many teachers at my school that have been teaching, you know, 10 years, and they change something up every year because it didn't work the year before. So, I mean, I just feel like it's hands-on. You just have to do it.
What's been the reaction from your colleagues at school, your fellow teachers?
My colleagues are so supportive. I love them. My principal is great. If I need anything, they're always there. It could be a question in the middle of class, you know. I mean, whatever. It can be a paperclip. They're always there. And actually, by me being the youngest teacher at the school, they kind of consider me the baby. And so, yeah, I love it. And so, you know, not saying that they baby me, but in a sense, you know, it's like they check on me periodically. I mean, it's just been amazing. It's been really amazing.
And Shelby, what about your colleagues?
My colleagues are great, too. I teach on a team of a four-teacher team. So we four teachers, we see all the same students, and the students rotate from class to class. And they've been extremely supportive. Anything I need, any questions I have, they'll answer. They're more than happy to help me out. And then in the same right, I'm not treated any differently than any of the other teachers, which I think is the way it should be. You know, there's no special privileges. There's no different expectations. Everything's the same, which is exactly how it should be. We're coming in there to do the exact same thing that all the other teachers are doing, and we should be held to the exact same standard. So the staff is very supportive. Anything you need.
Let me ask you, you're both teaching in schools that certainly have 80%, and I'm sure far more students on free or reduced lunch programs. So you're teaching poor children, children from poor families. We all assume, we all read that presents special challenges to teachers. Does it? Is that your experience?
For me, it hasn't been. Just because I feel like no matter where you come from, if your family has money or, you know, that they don't have money, any child can learn. And so my children, I feel like it's all about expectations. And if you expect for a child who comes from a low-income family not to learn, then they won't. And so I feel like as long as your expectations and your bar is the same as that child whose family makes millions as for the child who doesn't, then no. My children come in and they do the same thing. You know, I mean, I don't feel that that's a problem.
There has been a few situations in my experience where it has been something that needed to be addressed. You know, some students come wearing the exact same uniform shirt and pants every day, and the other kids will make fun of them. And so that's a special case, you know, very sensitive that you need to address with your students. And I agree with Anik, there's no difference in learning or teaching styles. The only time that it is ever anything that needs to be worried about are certain circumstances. Say if we have a school dance and the kids don't have money to buy a ticket, or if they don't have any paper left and they need more paper, or things like that where the kids, you know when the kids really need something and when they want it, and the kids are extremely grateful for any help that you can give them. They're just kids, you know, they're there and to learn, and so you teach them just the same, and then if they need the special little things, you know, you look out for them. They're your kids. They're my kids, so I look out for them. I take care of them if they need it, and they know that. They know that we're there for them.
I kind of feel like with my children, and this is just my opinion, that the most important things in life you can't buy anyway. So, and they understand that, and that's how we live.
Neither of you would be doing what you're doing, where you're doing it, if you didn't believe you could make a difference in your students and their performance. Why don't we see more improvement in student performance in inner city schools throughout the U.S.?
That is a tough question. I think Danique kind of touched on it earlier when she said expectations.
Yep.
I think that far too often people are too quick to lower their expectations for the reasons that you touched on, the low socioeconomic classes and stuff like that, which is not an excuse at all. Expectations should be the worst thing we can do is lower our expectations for someone. That's the worst thing we could do for them.
I totally agree with Shelby. She took the words right out of my mouth.
I want to tell you both how much I appreciate what you're doing and then visiting again with us on Smart City. And I hope you'll let us come back and talk with you again as the school year progresses. It's really interesting to hear the firsthand experience of teachers in inner city classrooms, and especially in their first year, getting to understand what the classroom is like and how they can be effective. It's great that you're both still enthusiastic about your work, and I thank you both for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Shelby Royer and Donique Nobles are Teach for America core members teaching in Memphis City Schools. After a break, we'll find out about a remarkable emergency medical transport system in Birmingham, Alabama, that won Harvard's Innovations in American Government Award. And we'll talk to Otis White about one of the most confounding laws ever. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Please explain what surely must be one of the most confounding laws ever, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000.
Well, where can I start, Carol? Let's start with the good part of it. It's a funny name, Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, and that's because it's really two laws sort of shot with a shotgun wedding there. The second part of the law, the institutionalized persons part of it, has to do with the way you treat people in custody, people in prison. And it allows folks in prison who follow a faith to be able to practice that faith without interference from the prison authorities. And who could argue with that? So you could get kosher meals if you're a prisoner. You could engage in religious services. You could wear turbans as long as it's part of your faith. And almost nobody could argue with this part of the law. It's the other part, the religious land use part of the act, which is just driving cities crazy. And it's tied to this fantasy notion that cities are somehow against churches, which I have seen a very, very little evidence of. In fact, lots of evidence to the contrary. And what it does is it pretty much exempts religious institutions from land use restrictions, as in you don't have to get zoning changed. You can build in higher densities or in different ways than is permitted by every other land use around you. You can even tear down historic buildings that the city is committed to restore. And this just happened recently in Baltimore, where the Catholic Archdiocese demanded and got a permit to tear down a 100-year-old apartment building called the Rochambeau, because it said, actually, it used a number of different excuses. The one that came up with it worked for them was they said, we really want to build a prayer garden there. And once they said those magic words, the city pretty much had to give them a permit to tear this down, even though the city has made enormous strides in preserving such old historic buildings, particularly in this corridor, which is trying to build residential uses. It just about had nothing it could say to the church other than, here's your permit. And, of course, this has caused an enormous uproar in Baltimore. And, you know, there's far more to it. I mean, there are other laws that have sort of driven cities crazy in dealing with churches. But that's the one that just seems to be the burr under most cities' saddles these days.
Well, it's an interesting story. And it's particularly interesting in light of the New York Times' excellent series on faith-based, government-supported activities that I think was a real eye-opener. I think we haven't heard the last of this.
I think not either, and thankfully it's getting a serious look these days.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist with Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week we check in with Steve Goldsmith, former mayor of Indianapolis and member of the selection committee for Harvard University's Innovations in American Government Award. Steve explains why a new emergency medical transport system in Birmingham, Alabama is attracting such attention.
Homeland security remains really a huge issue for local governments, and not only for the unknown of a terrorist attack, but for a hurricane or a weather event. For a large crash, bus or train or airplane, how do you plan for those, if you will, unknowns? And no single agency, no single local agency really can handle those on its own. But it is going to be the first responder. So how do those first responders come together? Each year, the Innovations Program at Harvard, in conjunction with MITRE Tech, presents an Innovations Award in Homeland Security, and this year it went to the Birmingham Regional Emergency Medical Services System, or BREMS. And what they did there is they brought together almost 200 emergency medical service providers, 19 hospitals, 2,000 EMTs, and said, all right, how do we create an inventory of where the emergency room beds and resources are located? How do we connect those resources with the providers? A very clever and exceptionally well-done technology called LifeTrack arranges those resources. So I really think what BREMS does is it shows us that one or two agencies can leverage a network of other resources. When you use high-quality technology, really visionary planning and an exceptionally well-organized and coordinated effort. It really is an exceptional activity that we can learn much from across the country.
With me now is Joe Acker, who runs the program. Joe, what is it about the Birmingham Regional Emergency Medical Services System that qualified it for a Harvard Innovator Award?
Well, we do things that no other emergency medical services system currently does in the United States. We combine our trauma system. We have the only multi-county, multi-hospital stroke system in existence in the world. We combine that with a bioterrorism syndromic monitoring system. And we also provide for hospital divert information, and all of that tied together to best serve all of the constituency in a six-county, 1.5 million population with 19 hospitals, 180 different EMS provider organizations, and over 2,500 EMTs.
That's amazing. How did you get all of those entities cooperating?
Well, this is a unique community. Birmingham and this region works together. The hospitals took the lead in this situation and have done very well working together for the best interest of the patient. That we've actually, they provide the funding for much of what we do. We've developed our software locally. This is a homegrown effort. Everybody works together to do what's best for the patient in this six-county region.
What was in it for the hospitals?
What is in it for the hospitals is that they make sure through this system that they only get patients when they have the appropriate resources to care for those patients. The second issue that was in it for the hospitals is that this system works daily on a patient-by-patient basis. When we have a mass casualty incident or a major disaster, then this system automatically ramps up, and that means the hospitals all know how it's supposed to work, the EMS providers all know how it's supposed to work, and so everybody works together. And it saves the hospitals money, it provides better patient care, and it ultimately saves the third-party payers a lot of money in that a hospital does not get a patient they don't have the current resources to care for.
So basically, if my emergency room is overflowing tonight, the system understands that and diverts patients to other emergency rooms.
Well, we do what we call route patients to other emergency rooms. And we look at not only just the emergency room status of a hospital, but the critical care bed capability, the med-surg bed availability, the labor delivery bed availability, their CAT scan availability, as well as their psychiatric secure bed availability. And then that information is also used in a passive process to assure that we are not getting a bioterrorism exposure through that syndromic monitoring process.
Now, syndromic monitoring, okay, help me out. I don't know what that means.
What we mean by syndromic monitoring is, let's say that we get an exposure to an agent that has an incubation period, whether that's a chemical or a biological agent, then what we want to do is catch the population while that is still in its incubation stage before it's begun a full-blown illness and spread patient to patient. And so what we want to do is look and see if our volume of, let's say, patients with skin rash problems or patients with respiratory distress or patients with GI problems are abnormal in that process. And as a result of that, we end up with identification of a resource or identification of a need in that situation. And public health, as well as emergency management, can make a decision about whether they want to inoculate, immunize, give prophylactic treatments, or isolate a given population.
Would that help, or would this system kick in with some of the recent food contamination outbreaks?
Yes, ma'am. In fact, one of the situations, about the only situation we've had since we started, is we had an exposure at one of our small barbecue restaurants here. And we identified that we had a problem because we had a number of people exposed to E. coli due to some bad meat. And those patients moved through the system, and one hospital after another went on divert. and we saw that the symptoms were similar. They were gastrointestinal symptoms. We didn't know what we had, but we knew we had something. We had a number of people that were ill and one death as a result of that. And we identified it early, and then luckily we were in a good situation that it went away very quickly because it was just a single source and a single population affected.
Is the information, Joe, captured by the emergency medical technicians in the ambulance situation? Is it collected at the hospital? At what point is it captured? And then tell me how it feeds into a larger system and who gets that information. Just give me a sense of how the information flow works.
The way that the process works is that we look at hospitals on divert. And when we have a certain trigger level of number of hospitals on divert at the same time in the same areas of either emergency department, ICU, or med-surg, and we hit that trigger, then immediately our system moves from a passive monitoring process to an active monitoring process. And we ask those hospitals only at that point to give us the information over the last 8 hours of how many patients with gastrointestinal, respiratory distress, or skin rash problems they have seen, and what is the result of that? How many were discharged? How many were admitted? How many were admitted to ICU? How many died? How many were sent home? And then on the basis of the feed of that material, we make a decision with public health and EMA about whether we need to move the system one notch up and go to our next alert stage. Now, the crucial part about this is that not all of these patients are going to come in through the EMS system or 911. Many times these patients will walk into emergency departments and not be brought by EMS, and they may even be interfacility transfers from outside our region. So this system passively captures all that data, and then more importantly, we only ask the hospitals for that information when we have identified a potential problem.
When you say a hospital that's on divert, tell me what that means.
What that means is that's a temporary process where they do not have the resources available to be able to offer that service. If it's an emergency department, it may mean that they have gotten a tremendous flow of patients in a short period of time, and they just can't take care of those patients. If it's a ICU situation, it could be the volume of patients. It could be a staffing problem. It could be a discharge problem because they can't discharge patients out of the ICU down to med-surg or wherever else they need to go. It's a variety of things, but it's a temporary process that hopefully that hospital will overcome. During peak periods in this system, we will run as many as 60 hospital divert changes in a 24-hour period.
Wow. I don't want to get too technical or ask you to get too technical, but just help me understand, when you built this system, I presume you weren't asking hospitals to change their systems in any way. Does this system lay on top of their own? I mean, does this lay on top of what was already there as communication or technology infrastructure?
Yes and no. There was no technology infrastructure, as there is not in most EMS systems in the United States. There may be a very crude process that hospitals notify given organizations when they go on divert. What this system offers is the centralization of that information. This system also offers the pooling of that information into a statistics process that allows the system and individual hospitals to look at not only their divert time, but other divert times. But the other thing that this system does that most systems don't do is that we recognize in emergency medical services here that we are not going to change the way hospitals operate.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is have the EMS system basically balance the way that we deliver patients and care for patients based on the hospital capacities that are there for us right now. Most EMS systems look at hospital capability, which means that I'm going to a level one trauma center. But what they don't look at is I may not be able to go to that level one trauma center because it doesn't have the current resources available to treat my patients. And we have to look at not just capacity or capability, We also have to look at capacity. And one of the major issues, if people have had a chance to read the Institute of Medicine's reports on emergency medical services to Crossroads, and also the other report dealing with hospital capacities, one recognizes that on a national level, there have to be EMS systems that adopt this type of philosophy to be able to make sure that the patients are delivered based not on just capability, but on capacity also. And it has to be regionalized, as we have done within a six-county region. You can't do this isolated city by city. You can't do it isolated county by county. It's got to be done on a tertiary patient flow issue.
I want to come back to something you said very early in our conversation, and that was the special attention you are paying to stroke victims. That's an issue in my family, and so I'm particularly interested in it. So indulge me here. Tell me a little bit more about how you're dealing with stroke victims and why you singled stroke victims out for special treatment in this system.
Well, let me first of all do something that as a interviewee, I should never correct the interviewer.
Oh, go right ahead.
But there is no such thing as a stroke victim. There are stroke patients. Stroke is a preventable disease, just like all types of cardiovascular disease. So that's the first thing that one has to understand, is that stroke is preventable. There are certain risk factors that we can modify. There are certain risk factors we cannot modify. What we do know about stroke that we did not know 5, 6, 7 years ago is we can treat stroke. But stroke to be treated has to be treated within a window of opportunity. In that window of opportunity, we will call for practical purposes here, the platinum hours. Just like we have the golden hour for trauma, we have the platinum hours for stroke. And we want a patient who is no more than 3 hours from the time that they have had initial signs and symptoms of stroke, last time seen normal, in other words. And we need to get that patient to a hospital that has an emergency room available where they can be automatically and very quickly assessed by the emergency medicine physician. Then we have to have the ability for a CAT scan very quickly, and then that CAT scan has to be read. And if that patient is a bleed patient, then we need to make sure they've got immediate access to a neurosurgeon, and we have some new drugs coming down the pipeline that will probably be approved after the first of the year that will make a dramatic difference in those patients' outcome, which are less than 20% of the patients. But on the 80% of the patients that are an ischemic stroke, in other words, a blockage in blood flow, we have two FDA-approved processes that allow intervention in the right hospital with the right neurologist's hands, and we can either give those patients a clot buster, or those clots can actually be retrieved from those blood vessels and the blood vessels opened up. But it's got to be done within that 3-hour window of opportunity. And what our system does is to look at those capabilities and capacities of hospitals in the region to be able to treat stroke. The paramedic calls with a patient who is exhibiting stroke signs and symptoms, and we route that patient only to a hospital that has those current resources online, and we know those resources are online because we poll all of those hospitals in an internet process, computer by computer, every minute. So we will not route a stroke patient to a hospital that does not have those resources available to treat that stroke patient.
One of the things that's very appealing about what you're saying is that some hospitals present themselves as, we have the stroke center, as an example, which is hard as a consumer or as a patient or someone caring for a patient. It's very hard to know if that's a marketing position or if that's real. And as you say, there's also a timeliness to it because you can be the stroke center but not have capacity. You may have capability, but not capacity. So this seems like a vast improvement over simply relying on a hospital to slap a label on something.
That's correct. And what we do in this system is we move. Competitiveness is great in healthcare,
mm-hmm.
but that competitiveness needs to be at the wholesale level. And we put that competitiveness between hospitals at the wholesale level where they are encouraged to keep those resources available. And then we're going to route the patients on the basis of where those resources are available, not what the billboard says.
Tell me this. I mean, it sounds like a wonderful system. How possible, how easy is it for other cities to adopt and duplicate a program like yours?
Well, the software is very, very easy to do. It's built. The issue is what I would call social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And that means people have to be willing to sit down around a table, whether it's hospital administrators, EMS providers, elected officials, and make decisions in the best interest of the patient, not in the best interest of their institution. And that is the tough part. But it works. And if it can work in a competitive situation like we have in Birmingham, and the forerunner for this system was a system that we put in place in Portland, Oregon in the 80s with their trauma system out there. And if it can work in two of the major metropolitan areas of the United States that have very competitive healthcare systems, it can work anywhere. People just have to want to make it happen.
Was there a single catalyst in Birmingham for making this happen?
Well, we did a study and we found out that 60% of our severely injured trauma patients were not going to hospitals where the hospital even had the ability to care for those patients.
Ow, 60%.
60%. And half of our pediatric patients were not going to our only pediatric hospital in the face of trauma. And those are pretty sobering statistics when you look at it. But when one looks, even in existing trauma systems, at patients who don't make it to the right hospital, or even if they make it to the right hospital, that hospital is so much over capacity that they can't provide timely care, that is a catalyst for anything to occur.
Joe, I appreciate the work you're doing. Thanks for talking with us on Smart City.
Yes, ma'am.
Joe Acker is Executive Director of the Birmingham Regional Emergency Medical Services System. The holiday season is a time for reflection on what we're thankful for, and it's an opportunity to turn our intentions toward giving to others. City View's commentator Walker Smith explains that it's equally important to invest ourselves in the community.
I got my first taste of political philosophy as a freshman when I had to read A Theory of Justice by John Rawls and Anarchy, State, and Utopia by Robert Nozick. The early 70s were colored by Watergate and calls for reform, if not outright revolution. Rawls and Nozick were leaders among the many thinkers of that period who helped shape the emerging social vision as the nation struggled to come to terms with how we should live together in the future. Both Rawls and Nozick argued for change, although from opposing points of view. Rawls felt that government needed to do more, while Nozick felt that government should do less. Rawls envisioned a society rooted in the social contract that people would agree to behind a quote-unquote veil of ignorance about the specific social position they would occupy. Rawls reasoned that such a social contract would include a big safety net that required those in more favorable positions to contribute enough to help those at a disadvantage. Nozick, on the other hand, advocated a minimal state in which market forces were given free rein so that everyone could compete to the fullest extent of his or her talents and ambitions. Nozick believed that even if placed in Rawls' hypothetical position, people would prefer an opportunity for unbounded success over a guaranteed safety net in the event of failure. Rawls was not an enemy of individuality, nor Nozick of community well-being. But in broad strokes, each proposed a different set of first priorities for society, community on the one hand versus individualism on the other. These philosophical positions are certainly not original to Rawls and Nozick, but in the charged atmosphere of the early 70s, their contemporary versions of these ideas were galvanizing. And so we debated whether we should march forth to champion Rawls' social contract or Nozick's libertarian minimalism. In the end, though, we did neither. Mostly, we just got swept along in the current of events. Individuality was on the rise, and the me decade was just too tempting to resist. Community obligations and traditions seemed old-fashioned. Dan Yankelovich said at the time that self-sacrifice had replaced self-fulfillment as the primary motive force in society. Christopher Lash wrote about this self-absorption in his evocatively titled book, The Culture of Narcissism. Without specifically intending to, although certainly without any regrets, we put Nozick into effect. But lately, we find ourselves wishing that we'd balance that out with a little bit of Rawls. Nowadays, pollsters find that the vast majority of us believe that community life has declined and that there is too much emphasis on individuals and too little on communities. Perhaps most importantly, over the last 30-plus years, we've come to realize that individual success is rooted in thriving communities. So now we have a new challenge for the future. To go back to school, if you will, on what we must do to rejuvenate our communities. To dust off our textbooks and brush up on what it takes to balance and enrich our individual lives with the deeper satisfactions and safeguards of community. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.